Oh, the tape. I guess we're a little bit late, but I understand that people were eating. And I didn't want to take you away from your sustenance. A lot of you have been working hard today, you board members. Where to begin? Someone told me that I had a big buildup there at dinner, and I guess I want to say that that I am not a professional teacher in this subject of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. I am, however, a person who has been fortunate enough over the last 10 years or so to meet a lot of Israelis and a lot of Palestinians, and have come to know them and care for them and feel very deeply about this tragic situation that they have been embroiled in for many years. In the sense that I'm not a teacher, I have not prepared great amounts of material here. I don't want to sit and talk to you for 55 straight minutes. I think most of you realize what has been going on in a general way in that part of the world for the past, well, at least since December of 1987. And you have certainly seen it on your television screens. And I would like to see myself in a position where I can kind of outline some of my impressions and tell you some things that I have seen and some people that I have talked with, and then we can have the chance to really discuss this. You should feel very free to interrupt me at any place along the line if I use a term that you don't know, or if there's something that I have touched upon that has struck a nerve. Please stop me, because if we let it go to the end, we might lose that thread. And I must tell you that I think, at least, I work much better in a situation where I answer questions and where we can relate to each other on that level. So please feel very free. I don't care if we go off on tangents. We have 5 sessions to discuss this issue, and I think we'll cover it quite well within that time. I want to discuss this issue from a real human point of view, because, as I said before, that's been basically my relationship to it. I'm not an academic. I am a person who, for the last, well, since 1979, worked with the Old American Lutheran Church in the Global Mission Division. In that job, I was responsible for all the communications work that happened with Global Mission. That gave me a chance to kind of look at the whole overview of the world. But during that time, I had a very deep involvement and interest in the Middle East. I guess all of us come to this subject, this very controversial and very emotional subject, with a certain history. And it's a history that tends to make us quite emotional about it, and in some cases quite opinionated about it. So I think you should know somewhat of my background so you'll know where I'm coming from. I took my first trip, went on my first trip to Israel in 1977. And it was quite interesting, because it was that introduction to this part of the world for me was totally from an Israeli point of view. One of the things I want to do later in some of these sessions is read some portions of a book that I think has done more to shape how Americans and, in fact, many people in the world view this situation than any other book, and that's Leon Orris's book, Exodus. How many of you read that? It was a big seller in about 1958, and I read it when I was 16 years old, and my goodness, it certainly colored the way I looked at that situation. So when I went to Israel in 1977, I was expecting to see Exodus. I was expecting to see the brave Israeli pioneers and all the rest. Though I must say, from the age of 16 on until the age of, I suppose, 32, I had gotten a little more sophisticated. But still, I looked at this situation totally from a pro-Israeli point of view, if you want to use that term.
Could you speak just a bit louder?
Yes, I will. Okay. If anyone here would like, there are some things here for anyone who can't hear particularly well. If you would like those,
would you
please.
Like it?
I'm sorry, I didn't. Okay. But anyway, so when I went in 1977, I went with that point of view. That I thought the Israelis were all the good guys, and not that I thought the Palestinians were the bad guys, except that I thought they kind of got what they deserved. You know, they had turned down in 1947, 48, they turned down the partition, that they had really brought all of this on themselves, and they were kind of unfortunate. But the Israelis were really the people who were so threatened and were so alone in the Middle East and facing this huge, enormous threat. I can remember having arguments with people who tried at that point in my life to tell me the story from the Palestinian point of view. I went and lived, my first association was with a kibbutz. Now, you can't get much more Israeli pioneer than that. Kibbutz Kfar Menachem. To this day, I have a relationship with that kibbutz, and I must tell you that I have what I would call a second set of parents who live on the kibbutz, and I think that's kind of nice. Every kind of uptight Norwegian Scandinavian should have Jewish parents. I think it's good for the soul. And those parents are now in their 70s, and I just saw them about a month ago. I lived in that kibbutz. I worked in that kibbutz. I became very, very close with all of those people, and to this day love them dearly and really agonize with them now in what they are going through and what they have gone through for the last year and a half. As time went on, after I got my job with the Lutheran Church, I also had a chance to travel to that part of the world and began to associate with the Christian community, which of course means I got to know some Palestinians. I got to know some Palestinian Christians, and I got to know some Palestinian Muslims. And all of a sudden, in these personal relationships, within the context of these personal relationships, my ideas started to change. Never did I come to the point where I said I'm either pro-Palestinian or pro-Israeli. I don't like those terms. I don't like them at all because they give you the idea that there is a right and there is a wrong here. I'm not saying that there are not rights and there are not wrongs within this situation, but in terms of the two communities together, there are certain historical happenings, events, if you will, that have really, in a way, cast these two communities in almost a scenario, in almost a play, that has really tragic overtones. It was, in a way, something, if you look at the history, certainly of the Jewish people, and I will look at that later on in the whole rise of Zionism and how that came about, that one gets the feeling almost that this was preordained, that it was some horrible tragedy that was preordained to happen. I don't like to dwell on that too long because that gives us a feeling that it's hopeless, and I don't think it is hopeless situation. But what I want to communicate to you by telling you this about myself is that I do believe, I think I look at the situation with a perspective that does see certainly the humanity of both sides. And I think as Christians who are involved in advocacy work vis-a-vis this issue, that it's important that we take that position as well. These people are not angels and devils. Some of them are good and some of them are bad on both sides of the issue. And it does none of us, certainly them, but not on, none of us any good to go around and make demons of people. Because believe me, the two sides in this situation have for the last 50 years made demons of each other. And they're very comfortable with making those demons. Because you see, if you make a demon of a person, if you make that person into a devil, then you don't have to deal with him or her as a real human being. They can be easily dismissed. And believe me, both sides have done that to each other for a long period of time, and I don't think we have to do it. So anyway, that's a little bit of an introduction of where I come from. What I hope to do tonight is again, give you just an overview of what has happened. I didn't want to take a historical perspective and start from the beginning of the Jewish people and the beginning of the Palestinians and come up to the future. I thought I'd start at the future, or at the present, and discuss a little bit about what is the uprising and how it came about. And then later on, go back tomorrow and look at the rise of Zionism. What is it? How it came about? Then we cannot talk about this issue, I'm convinced, unless we talk about the situation of anti-Semitism and the Holocaust. It is that great dark horror that always seems to hover over this conflict. And instead of ignoring it, I think we should face it head on, because as a Christian community, it has been that issue itself has been difficult for us, and in some cases it has kept us, I think, from discussing the conflict with clear eyes. We have a lot of overtones of guilt, and sometimes that guilt has made us very quiet. And I don't think we, certainly for both the Israelis and the Palestinians at this point, I don't believe we can stand to be quiet. I think that's just adding to the tragedy. After that, I want to talk in one session about the Palestinians. You know, there was this famous quote from Golda Meir, who said, "Who are the Palestinians? They don't exist. Where do they come from?" And that, of course, was an idea that a lot of people, just because there wasn't a country at that point called Palestine, who are they? Well, they can live somewhere else. You know, that whole thing. It's a very interesting thing to look at where the Palestinians did come from, and the rise of their own nationalist movement. Zionism was the nationalist movement of the Jewish people, and what we see now in the Palestinian people is their own response to that and their own movement toward nationalism. And then finally, to talk about where we go from here. Is there hope? What has been happening in terms of diplomacy? Certainly there was this last year we've seen incredible things that no one would ever have thought could happen. It's one of these times in history where the ice jam is broken. And now I speak about Yasser Arafat's speech in Geneva last December, where he acknowledged the right of Israel to exist, renounced terrorism, et cetera, and recognized the UN resolutions. So what we have is a time where things could move, but unfortunately, I don't think the time is quite yet at the point where great diplomatic strides can be made. There's something that tells me things are happening behind the scenes right now, but it's been quite silent, I suppose partially because of the big business with China. But anyway, there doesn't seem to be much happening right now. And we'll talk about perhaps then the role of the Christian church and the role of concerned people and how we as Americans might do something to help this process along. All right. The first thing I think we should do is just look at the map. As I said, I'm not a history teacher, but I think that's usually where people start. And some figures, which might help put all of this in perspective for you. Here we have a map of part of the Middle East. This black part here that I've outlined in black, that is what is called the West Bank, the occupied West Bank, which was seized by Israel as a result of the 1967 war. Also, here is the Gaza Strip. When you talk about the occupied areas, West Bank here, Gaza there, and then this little bit of blue up here is the Golan Heights, which has been officially annexed, made a part of Israel, as has East Jerusalem. These two areas have not been annexed. They are treated as simply occupied, militarily occupied territory. Let's see, what else should you know? If you have any other questions about the map, please ask me that as well. In terms of populations, it's very interesting to see how the Palestinian population is creeping up. Within Israel, there are approximately 3.5 million Israelis. That means Israeli Jews. In the West Bank, you have, well, people say 40, some people say 50, some people say about 60,000 settlers who have gone out in here and set up civilian settlements, meaning they have apartment buildings there, they commute to work from that area. In Gaza, there are about 2,000 settlers who are basically in agricultural settlements. The people who live here in the West Bank are not necessarily in agricultural settlements like, let's say, the classical kibbutz movement, when Jews began to come back to Palestine and set up agricultural settlements. These people are basically there because housing is cheaper. Some of them are there because of very fundamentalist religious beliefs that God gave us the West Bank and we as Jews have to live there. But a lot of them live there simply because housing is a problem in Israel and it's very expensive. And they have moved into the West Bank to take advantage of some cheap, nice housing. The housing in the apartments out there are very nice, except now, of course, you're going to get stones thrown at you if you drive out there. These, as I said, these settlers down here are basically agricultural. And it's also very interesting and somewhat tragic when you realize that there are approximately 600,000, 650,000 Palestinians living in Gaza, 2,000 Israeli settlers, and those 2,000 Israeli settlers control between a third to a half of all the water resources in Gaza, because they need that water to irrigate their agricultural settlements, their citrus groves, et cetera, et cetera. And what has happened as a result of that, since Gaza is so close to the sea, the water table has receded, and therefore these underground wells where all this water is being pumped out of for these 2,000 settlers, the salt water is coming in. And so soon there's going to be a very, very difficult and serious problem of water in the Gaza Strip. In terms of Palestinians, there are about 749,000 Palestinians living in Israel proper. Now, this means what will they say within the Green Line. That means that they are citizens of the State of Israel. They may vote. They may be elected to the Knesset. That's the parliament in Israel. They are supposedly full citizens of Israel. In terms of the law, they are. In terms of reality, they're very much second-class citizens, and that's another interesting thing we'll talk about later. Yeah?
The one thing they can't do is serve in the army.
That's
what leaves you all of the other rights that come only with army service.
Thank you, Paul. That's very good. That's a very good point. Because so much of social benefits in Israel come only in relation to the fact that you've served in the army. For example, you can get... it's like the GI Bill in the United States, in some sense. You get subsidies for housing, you get loans for education, et cetera, et cetera. So there are a lot of these kinds of benefits that are not available to Palestinians because, as they say, security reasons, they can't serve in the army. About 813,000 live in the West Bank, and these people are totally without political rights. They live under a military occupation. They are ruled by military orders. There's a little difference between the people who live in the West Bank and those who live in Gaza. About 600,000 people live in Gaza. Out of those 600,000, about 430,000 have what is called refugee status. meaning they are registered as refugees with the United Nations UNRWA, Refugees and Works Administration. Life in Gaza is very much different than is life in the West Bank. In the West Bank, there is much more free movement. Obviously, it's a larger area. It's much harder for the Israelis to patrol, et cetera, et cetera. Here in Gaza, what you have basically is a prison. It is surrounded by barbed wire. There are two entrances and exits, one up here going into Israel and one here going into Egypt. Gaza is quite an incredible place. I have the, let's see. It is approximately, let's see. I suppose we're talking about something like maybe 20 miles long and anywhere between 5 and 7 miles wide with a population of 600,000 people. That means some people have said that the population density is nearly that of Hong Kong. And it's very, very crowded. Though there are some parts of Gaza that are absolutely beautiful. When you drive along the ocean, I can remember being there about, it was just very near before the uprising began. And I just got the feeling that if peace could ever come here, this area would rival the French Riviera for a tourist industry. I mean, beautiful beaches and palm trees and the whole business, but then of course you go into the refugee camps and the situation is very, very different. All of Israel, I guess the other thing I wanted to talk about here too that you should know is that this is an incredibly small area. You don't realize that until you have visited the place. By the way, can I ask how many have been there? How many people from this? Okay, that's good, yeah. From the bottom here, a lot, up to the north, about 210 miles long. That's the whole country. And here at the narrowest part, you have 10 miles between Qalqilia, which is one of the large Arab towns in the West Bank, and Herzliya. So you can then understand a little bit about how the Israelis are always talking about security. It's very interesting. Whenever any foreign dignitary or person comes there to visit on a state visit to Israel, they always take them up here and show them the situation, which is, you know, in terms of defensible borders, there's certainly a point there. So anyway, that's all I want to say about the map. Is there any question, anything else about that? Okay.
It's
yes.
Government policy to resettle Israelis on the West Bank, is that correct? I mean, it's Israeli government policy. Is that why part of the reason that they're moving out there? I mean, the apartment building looked pretty nice and
yes.
Pretty expensive.
What happened in that sense is that after the 67 war, after this territory was taken by the Israeli army in 1967, the Labor Party in Israel, which has been traditionally the liberal part of the Israeli political spectrum, decided that they would put some settlements out there for military reasons. And in a sense, that was, from their point of view, justifiable in terms of military objectives, that there should be certain settlements out there as an early warning for the Jordanians, etc. So that's how the whole thing started, from purely military point of view. However, the other thing that happened after 1967 was that it awakened within a certain segment of the Israeli population, basically the right-wing religious nationalists, which now we see basically in the Likud party, the right wing, this incredible desire to populate and live in the areas that are closest, really, to Jewish history, to Hebron. The tomb of the prophets, I mean, Abraham is buried there. So you had people who said, look, we've got this land now. And in fact, there was a strain of Zionism, revisionist Zionism, which always said, we want all of it. We want all of it because God gave all of it to us, and we have the right to live there. And in fact, by living there, we are hastening the return of the Messiah. We are redeeming that land by living there. As things changed politically in Israel, the Labor Party lost its power, and the Likud gained. 1977 was another watershed year because it was that year that the Likud came to power. And the Likud government needed the political support from these right-wing people. So they allowed some settlements to begin. The main one being Kiryat Arba, which is in the town of Hebron. These people just moved in one day and they weren't going to move out again. So bit by bit, it became certainly people within the Likud government believed that political and religious ideology. But they also, in a way, had to go along with it because part of their political power came from this group. And therefore, they couldn't say no. And some of them didn't want to say no. Yes?
What is the religious background of the Zionists? It's my understanding that they are basically atheists.
Yes and no. It depends on the beginning pioneers, the early Zionist pioneers that came to Palestine before the turn of the century and immediately afterward were basically atheists. They came from Poland, they came from Russia, they came basically as with the Marxist philosophy. In fact, in my kibbutz, this is a thing that's quite interesting. The kibbutz where I've worked and lived is one of the most left-wing. There are a number of movements, kibbutz movements, that have slightly different philosophies, but they're very, all of them, quite left-wing. This one is the most left-wing, the Hashomer Hatzair movement. And this kibbutz had a picture of Joseph Stalin in their dining room until 1956. So that early group of pioneers was very much atheistic. They want nothing to do with religion. Later on, more religious people started to come, though there had always been a few religious Jews living in Palestine throughout the whole, all of the diaspora. But the religious groups are now growing. They're still very much a minority, but they're growing in power within the government. And so, as I say, they're still a minority, but it's also a problem in the sense that there's a great deal of conflict now between the secular Jews and the religious Jews on issues of, there'd be big battles in the streets on Friday night in Jerusalem because the secular people wanted to go to movies and the religious people wanted those theaters shut down. So one thing that I've always thought is that if and when it might be possible to settle this issue in the Palestinian-Israeli conflict, there are going to be a tremendous number of conflicts within Israel itself that have been easily ignored simply because, you know, there's this great external threat. Well, if you manage to get rid of the external threat or deal with the external threat, then you're going to have to deal with some very serious internal threats as well. So, yes.
Is there a specific reason why when Israel was originally established that the Gaza Strip and the West Bank weren't included in the boundaries?
Basically...
Could you repeat the question?
Yeah.
Was there a specific reason when Israel was established that the Gaza Strip and West Bank weren't included within its boundaries?
Yes, it was because of the UN partition plan. When the United Nations partitioned Palestine, in 47, these were the boundaries that were agreed upon, were accepted certainly by the Zionists. Of course, they weren't accepted by the Palestinians because then there was the war.
Actually, the boundaries of pre-67 Israel are 30% larger than the partition.
Right. Yes.
So it was even smaller. There were more areas that were set aside for the Palestinians besides the West Bank and Gaza.
Right. The Israelis managed as when the partition plan was rejected by most of the Arab world, and the war, as the Israelis call it, the war for independence, broke out. Then the Israeli army, after a couple of weeks of being really pretty much tied down because of a lack of weapons, then kind of turned around and managed to push those borders out. So what you see here is, as Paul says, considerably more than what was originally given to them by the United Nations. Yes?
Could you define exactly what a kibbutz is?
A kibbutz is a communal farm. It's a very interesting social experiment where supposedly it has evolved quite a lot in recent years. But at least it's very interesting because in the kibbutz is one place where you can find kind of a pure form of economic communism living alongside a pure form of political democracy. Everything is owned in common. There's supposedly not to be private property, but now there is. I'll give you the ideal. The other thing that is quite interesting about the lifestyle is that because in the beginning there was such a need for labor, women, because of socialist Marxist principles also, were going to be liberated. Therefore, they were not to do the kind of traditional women's roles of washing and ironing and caring for the children, whatever. All of the work was to be shared on an equal basis. So the children did not live with their parents. The children lived in what were called children's houses. That freed the women to work in the fields or work in the communal laundry. You didn't have to do your own laundry. You ate together in a communal dining hall, et cetera, et cetera. So in that sense, there was a rather pure form of economic communism with everything owned in common, and yet there were meetings at least in my kibbutz, it happens every Saturday night, where the kibbutz comes together and makes decisions, and they make decisions about everything from what they'll do for the profits that have been gained through the last year to whether so and so will go and study at Hebrew University or so and so will go on vacation to the United States, et cetera, et cetera. So it's an agriculturally based community, and there are very few of them now. I think the kibbutzniks now make up, perhaps, used to be 10 years ago, about 6% of the population. They're down to about 3 or 4% now because the younger generation are leaving. Kibbutzniks are, in a way, they have been until lately very much respected by the Israelis, the other Israelis, because of the great contributions that kibbutzniks made. If you look at the number of casualties that were taken in the wars, the kibbutzniks were always on the front lines. They've always been, up until the last 15 or 20 years, the leaders in the government. There was a mystique about them, and yet at the same time they were looked at by the rest of Israelis as kind of country hicks. And now with the change in the government from the Labor government to the Likud government, they are also very much ridiculed because they have the fancy lifestyle. And I mean, I look at my kibbutz now, and it's like living in a garden. It is an absolutely beautiful place to live. There's a swimming pool. There are huge dining hall, beautiful facilities. People have color television sets. There are telephones in everybody's house, that kind of thing. So it is definitely the lifestyle has changed a lot. I think what I better do is get on with the uprising, so we'll be able to have some kind of order here. I can remember sitting in in Gaza along along the coast having lunch. I think it was probably late November 1987, and was there on a trip. I'd never been in Gaza before, and was having lunch with a number of leaders of the community, one of whom was the head of the citrus growing cooperative in Gaza. Another was this is a wonderful man who's head of the Palestine Red Crescent Society, Dr. Abu Shafi, whom many of you may have seen. Did anyone here see the Ted Koppel Nightline show when it happened from Israel? Yeah, right. Well, I have also happened to be in the audience that night. That was quite an interesting experience to watch that happen live from Jerusalem. And Dr. Abu Shafi was there that night as well. Well, nothing could have seemed less likely at that point than 2 weeks later people would be killed and shot and throwing stones in Gaza. It seemed, it was such a beautiful day, the sun was shining, everything seemed quiet. Of course, I'd been in the refugee camps, and it was a miserable thing to see, but there was no indication at all that anything was going to happen. About 2 weeks later, I believe on about December 8, there was a series of incidents that set things off. There had been a stabbing in Gaza City of a Jewish settler, and that happens from time to time, incidences of violence like that. But then two or three days later, there was a major accident on the road just going out, I think just before Gaza. The other thing you should know is that while there are these 600,000 people in Gaza, 430,000 of whom have refugee status, about 50,000 to 60,000 Gazans leave every day from the Gaza Strip to go to take jobs. Very low-paying, menial work in Israel. They're dishwashers, they're garbage collectors, they work on construction sites, and some of them have, some of these jobs are regular jobs that they go to every day. Their wages are much lower than would be paid to Israelis. They have no social benefits that go along with these jobs, meaning they have no social security, no health insurance, etc. Some of them simply go up to Tel Aviv and stand on the corner hoping that they will be hired as day laborers. So there's a tremendous amount of traffic that goes in and out of the Gaza Strip every day. I've been on that road. It's a very bad road. It's a two-lane road. And you can imagine the amount of traffic when you have 50 or 60,000 people commuting every day for work on the road. There was an accident on that road. And a van that was carrying three or four of these Palestinian workers was rammed by an Israeli vehicle. Now, nobody knows if it was intentional or if it was simply an accident. I have a feeling it was probably an accident, considering how people drive in that part of the world and how bad the road is. But what happened is that it immediately went through the community that this was retribution for the murder of this settler who had been stabbed 3 or 4 days ago. And the rumor just flew through the refugee camps. And people started throwing stones. It was a kind of quintessential example of the top blowing off of a festering wound that had been festering for many, many, many years. There were people in Israel who said, you should have expected it. It was coming. There had been, during that last year, many more incidences of violence. And I had been reading, I had been watching the Jerusalem Post and had been feeling that something was going to happen. Well, of course, the rest is history. At the beginning, there were a few people shot that day. It spread to other refugee camps. It started in Jabalia camp, which is the biggest camp in Gaza. By 2 or 3 days later, other people were throwing stones. Then it moved into the West Bank, which was very shocking to the Israelis because they had been accustomed to dealing with, with clashes in the Gaza Strip, but not so much in the West Bank. And then when it also moved to East Jerusalem, people became very, very concerned. I remember perhaps a week after it started watching this evening news one night, and there was a report that some kids in Gaza had been running toward the Israeli soldiers with their chests bared, saying, "Shoot me, kill me, I dare you." And I said to myself, "Ah, this is something very different. This means that the world has changed, and things will never go back to being the same." The Israelis didn't know what to do. They, at the beginning, the military people said, "Oh, this is just outside instigators. These are outsiders that are stirring up trouble." They couldn't quite believe that this was the beginning of a massive popular uprising that would claim now what we have, 525 victims, I guess. I think one of the reasons that the Israelis couldn't believe it is that the Palestinian population had been so docile for all of these years. We were talking here of 20 years of occupation. The occupation began in 1967. And considering the number of people, I mean, look at these numbers. West Bank, 813,000, Gaza, 600,000 people. Those are that's a lot of people to keep under a military occupation. And considering the numbers and considering that it had gone on for 20 years, it's quite amazing. I'm just amazing that it didn't happen before. And I can remember listening to people from the West Bank and listening to people from Gaza say continuously over 8 or 9 year period, "Oh, you know, why doesn't the United States do something about this? Why doesn't Europe do something about it?" There was never any indication, and that's why I guess it was somewhat a surprise to me that they had never kind of taken responsibility for their own future. But then when I went to do this book in the summer of 1986, I went to Israel and the West Bank and Gaza, and I started interviewing young Palestinians, and they were saying things that I had never heard before. One of them is a newspaper editor. His name is Daoud Kutab, and I remember sitting with them talking in East Jerusalem, and he started saying things that I realized something was changing. He said, we have to be responsible for ourselves. We can't depend on anybody else. We have to take our fate into our own hands. And after that interview, I thought, this is something different. I have not heard this before. And if this is any indication, then something may be brewing. So the Israelis were surprised because, as I said, the population had been rather docile. Of course, there'd been incidences, violent incidences of stabbings and some, you know, other kinds of things. But again, considering the number of people and the time, it's surprising the little violence there was there. Also, I think the Israelis had become quite comfortable with the occupation. It was comfortable again because, considering the number of people and the little violence, the Israelis could live with it. They needed the source of labor that came to them from the West Bank and Gaza. That was necessary. They needed the dishwashers. They needed the garbage sweepers. They needed construction workers. There was also a tremendous amount of taxes that came from, certainly from the West Bank, and with not a lot in return. So it was also, the occupation was positive in the sense that it was a source of labor and it was a source of funds. And the other thing that's quite amazing to me is that when you think of the land we're talking about here, the tiny area, Gaza might have been the other side of the world as far as most Israelis thought. It became very, very clear to me that after I had been in Gaza, and then I went back and spoke with Israeli friends in the kibbutz, in other places. And these are people who are not right-wing people. These are people who are Labor Party people. These are people who are concerned with the fact that Israel had occupied the West Bank for 20 years. But they didn't have the slightest idea of what was going on in Gaza. Some of them didn't want to know, but some of them didn't have any idea, and didn't want to have any idea. They didn't go to Gaza. They could, up until I think probably 2 years ago, they could have traveled in Gaza and looked around, but they didn't. And then there was this kind of strange, I don't know how to explain it, strange, irrational, I guess irrational is the only word I can use. I think on that first trip to Gaza, the image that will always remain in my mind was of a resort. We were driving along the coast, and all of a sudden we came to a thing that looked like there were cabanas, you know, a little kind of a resort area with thatched roofs and everything, and it looked kind of like those come to the South Sea travel posters, that kind of thing. But the thing that was strange about it is that there were these 9-foot-high spiked fences that were surrounding the place, and inside were guards with guns, with machine guns. And I said to the man who was traveling with me, who is a staff member from the Middle East Council of Churches, I said, "What is this?" And he said, "Oh, this is a resort." I said, "A resort?" He said, "Oh, yeah, this is a resort. Israelis come down here for their vacations." And I couldn't understand how that could happen. He said, "Well, yes, they used to bring them down by car or bus from Tel Aviv, but now, when things have gotten a little more tense, they get on boats in Tel Aviv and they come down here, and then they get off the boat so they don't have to, if they drove through Gaza, they'd be stoned. But they come down here and they take their vacations." And it was at that point when I started to get very frightened, because I thought, people who honestly believe that it isn't strange to take your vacation under armed guard have really, I fear, lost their sense of reality. And that's a very, very frightening thing, because this was not a normal kind of situation. So again, that was part of it too, why it came as a surprise to the Israelis, because it was as if Gaza didn't exist, out of sight, out of mind. We don't see them, they're not here, we don't want to see them, finished. So that was part of it as well. Yes?
As you talk, there seems to be a number of similarities between what the Israelis are doing to the Palestinians as what the whites are doing to the blacks in South Africa. And yet, as a people, we tend to somewhat condemn the whites, but yet we still condone them, where the Israelis were backing at just an astronomical figure per capita on a yearly basis.
I have, numbers of people have said that to me when they compare the situation to South Africa. I've always believed that I don't like to make those comparisons, because Israelis are Israelis and South Africans are South Africans and Palestinians are Palestinians. And I think if we make those comparisons too easily, then we don't look at the situation. It's kind of intellectual shorthand, where you can say, oh yes, they're acting just like the South Africans. Certainly there are some similarities. And this fact is not lost on either Americans, nor is it lost on Israelis themselves. There was a terrible flap about 2 weeks ago when the Israelis have been very concerned now, because there are more and more incidences of violence happening in places that you shouldn't expect it. that means in the West Bank and near some of the settlements. And a lot of these settlements in the West Bank, of course, employ Arab labor. So what they made these people do was come on to the settlements wearing a certain badge, which identified them as guest workers or foreign workers. And within Israel itself, that just caused a huge hue and cry, because of course there are terrible historical parallels for that.
Star of David.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. So, you know, when things happen like that, there is a part of me that says there still exists within the Jewish, Israeli Jewish soul, a sensitivity, and a you know, it's not for nothing that God gave the Jews the Ten Commandments. I mean, there's still that great tradition of ethics, and if you could meet some of the Israelis who day in and day out are fighting for this, I tell you, one of the things that is the most touching to see on Friday afternoon, again, we're making a South Africa parallel, but it's called the Women in Black. You know, in South Africa, the black sash women who stand on the corner and they don't speak to anyone. They just stand there as a symbol of a quiet symbol against the apartheid system. Well, they're the same. They're women in Israeli women who stand and do the same thing on the streets in Jerusalem. So it's there are parallels. But I've always said, you know, it's crazy the way the word Nazi gets thrown around in that part of the world. The Israelis call the Palestinians Hitler, and the Palestinians call the Israelis Nazi. And the fact is that they're neither. They're Israelis and they're Palestinians. And if the Israelis are going to be brutal, let's allow them to name their own kind of brutality. They aren't Nazis. But I, do you see what I'm saying? Yes, there are parallels, but let's not run along with the parallels so much that we don't take time to look at the specific situation or the specific circumstances that have made this conflict different than any other that exists in the world. What are we doing for time here now? When do we stop? I forget.
10 up, I think.
Yes, 10 up.
About 8 minutes.
About 8 minutes left. I guess we should also talk a little bit about how this uprising has affected both the Israeli community and the Palestinian community. In terms of the Palestinians, it has unified the community to a greater extent than I certainly have ever seen in all the time that I've visited that part of the world. The Palestinians do not have a history of any kind of democratic institutions, nor do they have particularly a history of independent thinking in the sense of making political decisions. The Palestinian community has been one that has been basically a tribal in the sense that there were certain families who traditionally held power, the Nashashibi family, the Husseini family, this and that. So there was not a tradition of grassroots decision-making happening within the community. And the Israelis were always very adept at, like other situations, of manipulating these kind of inter-family rivalries to their own good. There is a tremendous number of informers within the Palestinian community. Now you see, I don't know how many of these informers have been murdered within the last 6 or 7 months. So the Palestinian community was not one that was particularly unified by, certainly one could say they shared, majority of them shared the Islamic faith, but in terms of making political decisions, it was pretty much every person for himself. And you can understand that. If you live under occupation and things are difficult, you want to see that you you get what's coming to you and, you know, my family and my group, but forget any kind of pan community concern. That has really changed. And it's been amazing to watch it change. When the schools were shut, when the schools were closed down, right away there began an underground movement to have instruction in homes. Neighborhoods were organized so that, let's say, somebody wanted to know how many people were living in a certain neighborhood, what kind of blood did they have, what was their blood type, so in case there would be necessity for giving blood, they would know where those people are. The leadership of these local communities was for the first time democratically elected. It wasn't just so-and-so is the leader because his father was such-and-such or he is so-and-so. It was, for the first time, he or she is the leader because of their ability, which is an incredible step for the Palestinians to make. The other thing that had been to the Palestinians' detriment was their system of education, which has always not encouraged creative thinking or independent thinking. They used the Jordanian system of education, which was basically memorization. And that was their idea of education. While, of course, on the Israeli side, you had a whole different view of education to encourage students to think for themselves and to be creative and this and that. And one of the things that I am most proud of in terms of the ELCA's, Evangelical Lutheran Church in America's, involvement in that part of the world, though it is very small, is that we give a grant to a project called Education for Awareness and Involvement. And this is quite an extraordinary program in that there are people at this moment who are working on revising the entire Palestinian educational curriculum. I mean, that's an incredible thing to think about, but they are doing that at this very moment, and we are at least helping them, giving them some money to do that, and are assigning now one ELCA missionary as a consultant to that program to help them do that, so that when and if there is a Palestinian state, that they will be ready with a new curriculum to introduce in their schools, so they can start. They can start encouraging their students to be creative and to think. The thing that's amazing is that young Palestinians don't know anything about their country. They don't know their history. They don't know their archaeology. They don't know their geography. And so one of the other people who works in, who is an ELCA missionary, is a man named Al Glock. And he is the chairperson of the Archaeological Institute at Beer Zeit University. And it is Al's contention that a people cannot be a people until they know who they've been. They can't become until they know who they were. And in terms of archaeology in that part of the world, it has basically been owned by the Israelis and it's been owned by the British and the Americans. And the good stuff, of course, was way down below. So these archaeologists would just come in and go through the Ottoman period and the other periods and just toss this stuff out because it wasn't really important. They wanted the good stuff that was way down there. But of course, within the stuff they threw out were things that were very important to the Palestinian community. So what Al is doing now is he's got a group of about three or four young Palestinian archaeologists. And even though the university is closed, the work of the Archaeological Institute still goes on, and they're just over there at Beer Zeit University, kind of doing their archaeological work, and that's a very important kind of thing to do for a people who are trying to discover who they've been, so that they can become. There's more that I should have said here. I'm sorry we got off a little bit off on a tangent, but I told you I'm not a professional teacher. And I want us to be able to discuss this freely and openly. We have four more sessions, so don't worry about it too much. If we're close to chapel, so maybe we should, if there are any other questions.
Where is Mubarak Awad?
Where's Mubarak Awad? He's in this country. Mubarak Awad is quite an extraordinary fellow. It was also interesting for me to see at this meeting that I told you about, where I was sitting having dinner with these leaders in Gaza. Mubarak Awad had become very involved he was the founder of the Palestinian Center for the Study of Nonviolence. And I had gotten to know Mubarak 2 years ago when I met him in Geneva and was very impressed with him. He is married to a Quaker, and some of his ideas of nonviolence came from his wife, Nancy. A lot of Palestinians just dismissed him. And I can remember saying that day to these people who I was having lunch with, after we'd been talking for about 20 minutes, what do you think about Mubarak Awad? And they said, he's this nonviolent stuff, it's not really going to get us anywhere, and on and on and on and on. It was very interesting to see, less than 3 months later, these leaflets that would come out from the underground leadership of the uprising saying the same thing that Mubarak Awad had been saying, meaning general strikes, all of these nonviolent resistance kinds of things. And all of a sudden, Mubarak Awad was arrested by the Israelis as being one of the leaders of the... that wasn't the reason they arrested him. They arrested him because they said he'd overstayed his visa. And for the first time, the United States government got into the middle of it. And I was very proud of what they did in Jerusalem. They held a news conference, and they simply said to the Israelis, this is a person that you should be talking to. Don't deport this guy. He's nonviolent. But, of course, in the end, the Israelis won, and Mubarak Awad was deported. And he is now living in the States and has been speaking quite widely to groups all over the United States. I was very proud of him when he came back. He appeared on the McNeil Lehrer News Hour and did quite a wonderful job that night. He tends to be not a particularly articulate man, but his English is getting better and better all the time. But he's a real good guy. Okay. Thanks.